Welcome to Liberty for Layman podcast. My name is Andy Katherman, and today we will be discussing the upside-down world of MMT, or Modern Monetary Theory. Our distinguished guest is economist, prolific author, and scholar, Dr. Robert P. Murphy. Dr. Murphy studied his undergrad at Hillsdale College and earned his PhD in economics from NYU. He is the author of several excellent books, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, as well as The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, also Lessons for the Young Economist, and Study Guides to Man, Economy, and State, Human Action, and most recently, Mises' Theory of Money and Credit. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Andy. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being on. And I'd also like to throw out, Dr. Murphy is also teaching an upcoming 5-week course at Mises Academy about the economics of the Great Depression, and we will link to the ad and whatnot, how listeners can subscribe to that and take your course if they'd be interested. So I'm excited about that. The basis for this show is we're talking about modern monetary theory. And so those that are not familiar with this type of very maybe complicated or somewhat complicated monetary theory, Robert, could you give us the audience a little bit of a background of what it is, who is the proponents of it, and just a little overview of it?
Well, sure. I mean, I think the most famous proponent nowadays is Warren Mosler, and he's got a website devoted to this, and it goes by various names. So his famous book is Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds of Economic Policy. And that's written for the lay person and going over things that sound very orthodox and conventional. And he sort of turns them all on their head to show that it's not. And he has lots of followers, and they go out by the name of the MMT, for Modern Monetary Theory, on the internet a lot. And it's mostly accounting. That's the way I would crystallize it, is to say they have a lot of accounting truisms, and then try to derive from them things about economic causality to try to sort of turn things on their heads. So things that a lot of people, even economists, think are sort of economic laws or principles, Mosler and his disciples will sort of spin them around and try to show that, well, no, actually, that these aren't true once you learn the accounting. And so you try to argue with them in terms of economic concepts, and they'll be coming at you with accounting identities. And at first, it catches a lot of people off guard because they don't know the intricacies of how Mosler and his disciples approach these issues. And so, it's kind of hard to argue with them on their own terms. And they can come away looking like, hey, you've got your conjectures out there, these things that might or might not be true. We're dealing here with accounting certainties, the identities, the things that have to be true. And so they're very effective rhetorically in terms of the history of economic thought. I think a lot of their work can be found in the ranks of Abba Lerner and people in that train of thought. So it's not like Mosler developed all this out of the top of his head, but he's certainly the living guy who is probably the leading exponent of the sort of thing we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and briefly, I've heard the phrase chartalism. Is that kind of the precursor of what this MMT and
Yeah, right, yeah.
Okay. And I think because they're two, I always see those kind of linked together, but I think the MMT is more of the brand now. So the basics for what I hope to get out of this show is, and what was my inspiration for the show, is I was having a conversation online with a friend of mine from high school who is a financial planner, very sharp guy, and he gave this statement talking about the presidential campaigns, talking about Romney and Obama. He basically said Obama is bad because he wants to raise taxes. And I was like, okay, well, that's, I probably agree with that. Then he goes, Romney is bad as well because he wants to cut government spending. And then we had some back and forth and back and forth. And then he basically, it smelled like MMT. I was like, seems like familiar or something I've heard. And then he gave me this book that I'd like to get into this, he pointed me to this book called Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds of Economic Policy by Warren Mosler. So let's just get into those frauds right away.
Sure. And if I might just preface what we're going to do by saying I'm not claiming that I'm, you know, an expert on this area of thought and whatever. So I'm sure, you know, people who believe in this would get upset and say, well, no, there's all sorts of subtle nuances that you and I are missing. And it's not the exact same thing as chartalism and that. So let's just say that as a caveat, but I do think that Mosler, as we go through these things, is either saying something that's true, but he's drawn the wrong conclusion from it, or what he's saying is technically true, but it's extremely misleading.
Sure, I totally agree. And I think one of the things I admire so much about you is that you go out of your way to really make sure that you understand a person you're arguing with or trying to understand, you try to present their argument in a true way or a non-threatening way and say, hey, if I understand you right, this is what you're saying. Is that correct? And you do a great job of not, belittling or ad hominems to other authors and scholars. So that's what I hope that we will do here. Obviously, as you just said, we may offend some purists if we didn't get it right, but we'll take a stab at it. And I know that you're probably as good a person as any is to help us navigate these MMT waters. So, all right. So the first fraud, I was going to say sin or the fraud that he presents is, and this is from his book, the government must raise funds through taxation or borrowing in order to spend. In other words, government spending is limited by its ability to tax or borrow. That's a fraud. And Mosler's response is governments issuing debt in their own currency can never go. I'm paraphrasing here, and so maybe we can get into this. Mosler says governments issuing debt in their own currency can never go bankrupt, since they can print or credit money to anyone and everyone, since it has a printing press and or whatever he wants to call it, a ledger sheet with debits and credits that it can give to whoever it wants to. So let's address that first fraud.
Sure. So here, this is an example of what I mean, and this is very typical, I think, of what Mosler does. Is he's taking something that's a bit imprecise, but that has a spirit of truth behind it, like a lot of economic wisdom behind it, and then he's pointing out that technically that's not exactly correct, and then seems to walk away and leave the reader with the wrong impression. All right, so he is right, and with all this stuff, Mosler, he's talking about a country whose government issues a fiat currency that it has control over, right? So this stuff wouldn't necessarily apply to Spain because they're on the euro and then they can't directly control how many new euros are printed and so forth. And it wouldn't apply to the United States in 1932 because they were still on the gold standard at that point. So all of this stuff he's talking, the context he has is that it's a country that is on its own fiat currency. And its government or its administrative authorities are the ones determining what we would call monetary policy. Okay, so within that context, he's saying it's impossible for the government, the central government, or what we call the federal government of the United States, to ever go broke. That if they owe somebody money, they can just create new money and give it to them. And this is what I mean, where Mosler is very intimidating, is he goes through the actual mechanics of how that happens in terms of the reserve accounting. And the central bank does this, and then there's credits and this and the debits and credits and so forth. But I mean, what he's saying, it boils down to, is that they could just run the printing press and hand new $100 bills over to somebody. And that the government has the legal authority to do that, because the dollar's not backed up by anything. And so that's the sense in which he's saying, we don't need any taxes. You know, the government can spend whatever it wants, tax zero, and doesn't even need to borrow anything. You say, oh, what if lenders get spooked? We don't need to borrow money from anyone. We could just print whatever the government wants to spend in a given year. Or if we had outstanding government debt and we owed people money, we don't need to default. We don't need to be able to roll that debt over if new investors are scared. We just print up the $100 bills and hand it over, and boom, we just paid you off.
Sure.
So that's what he means. And so, he's right that technically if someone says the federal government was raised funds through taxation or borrowing in order to spend, that's not correct. But it's the sort of obvious rejoinder to his position is to say, well, sure, but if the government just keeps printing money like that, it's going to cause price inflation. And then he acknowledges that too, and that's where I think we might get into this later, where in his view the point of taxation is to limit price inflation. But in his mind, and his equations are correct, and the accounting is technically true, but by calling it a deadly fraud to say the government must raise funds through taxation or borrowing, and then to say, no, the government is in no danger of ever being insolvent, he certainly leads the reader to think that, you know, there's no economic reason for the government to have to watch its spending. When, no, what would happen is if the government spends a lot of money, then it's going to cause price inflation, and that's going to make everybody else poorer because of the government spending.
Right.
And it's right, yeah, technically the direct mechanism might not be because the government has to raise taxes or because investors lend all their funds to the government. It could be because they run the printing press, but either way, there's a lot of wisdom behind the statement that, hey, the government, if it gets too big, is going to leave the rest of us poorer. And he, even though he doesn't technically say it, certainly tries to disarm that fear among his readers, and in my mind, does a disservice by making them think that, oh, don't worry about it, the government can just print up money, when that's hardly a good, that's not reassuring.
Sure. Yeah, and I think what I've noticed is that he's, as you said, he's technically correct, but he doesn't go a step further to say, well, what are the effects of government issuing as much fiat currency as it wants or without taxing or borrowing or anything like that? And I feel like, as you said, he gets it, he's technically right, but he does. It's like a good economist would be able to say, "What are the economic effects of action A?" And so I do think that is sorely missing in that, especially in that first fraud. But I think he does that on purpose. But we'll leave that to.
Yeah, and I mean, and even here too. I mean, you know, as I'm scrolling, I've got his PDF in front of me as we're going through this, and he does even have in bold face, so I could see some of his fans jumping up and down and saying, "What are you guys talking about?" He's got it on page 22 of his book in bold. This, however, does not mean that the government can spend all it wants without consequence. Overspending can drive up prices and fuel inflation. You know, so that's okay, but it's kind of a footnote. Well, it's not even a footnote, but I'm just saying the way this is used in terms of the political rhetoric and the people who argue with it, they use this to beat, you know, small government types over there. So people who are saying, whoa, we got to pull back our spending, you know, the government's going to run out of funding or something. And they're, you know, in other words, it's like their point is to say, no, the reason the spending program is awful isn't because the government's going to run out of money. It's because, or isn't going to be able to pay for it. Maybe that's one way of putting it. Like, If Obama comes out or says, hey, we're going to have a new healthcare program, it's going to cost $10 trillion, and then people, you know, the man on the street and the conservatives and right-wingers say, whoa, that's too expensive. How is the government going to pay for that? And then Mulder and these guys are saying, oh, you idiots, the government will pay for it could just by printing money.
Right.
And then if you push them and say, oh, okay, but won't that cause massive inflation that will impoverish everyone? You know, then they'll say, well, yeah, sure, but our point was just the government's going to be able to pay for it. So, on the one hand, we should be precise, especially if we're talking about professional economists, but to use this to beat people over the head who are aghast at costly government spending programs, I think it's the way I've seen this used in practice is not someone who's very concerned about the level of government spending and is just saying, hey, guys, let's make sure our argument is let's dot all the I's and cross all the T's. They're using it to sort of, you know, beat back economic ignorance in their mind.
Right. All right. Well, let's go to the second fraud, and then we'll take a little quick break. The second fraud from his book, quote, with government deficits, we are leaving our debt burden to our children. And that's a fraud. And Mosler says, well, collectively in real terms, there's no such burden possible. Debt or no debt, our children get to consume whatever they produce. Well, I know that you probably have a lot to say on this because I see on your blog you've gone back and forth with, I believe it's either Dean Baker and or Nick Rowe, I believe, who is a professional economist, about this, do government deficits burden our children? So I wonder if you could maybe, you know, spend a few minutes discussing this fraud or alleged fraud.
Sure. So here's an example on this particular one where Mosler's just wrong. All right. He's making an assumption to get his answer when he's just wrong. That if you relax the assumption and made it more realistic, then the man on the street's intuition is correct. So let me explain, you know, where Mosler's coming from. And you're right. The reason I'm so intimately familiar with the nuances of this particular issue is that Paul Krugman and Dean Baker, last December, so they've been in December of 2011, were advancing this argument saying, like, oh my gosh, all these right-wing idiots talking about if we have a big debt today, we're going to pass it on to our grandchildren and make them poor, and we're living at the expense of our descendants, and that's crazy. And they had the same view that Mosler is advancing here. So let me just make sure people understand where they're coming from, and then we'll see what's wrong with it. So what they're thinking is, look, when the government today borrows money and then, you know, it spends $100 billion through deficit spending and gives some goodies to old people, let's say, that the resources used to fund that transfer payment, they don't have like a time machine. It's not like they literally can go to the year 2100 and take TVs and food away from the kids or from the people living in 2100 and pull them back and consume them today. So their point is whatever it is that we consume today comes out of present production. And then they're saying now if we fast forward to the year 2100, whether they have a government debt of zero or of $200 trillion, it doesn't matter that collectively every American who's alive in the year 2100, you know, if there's a huge government debt and they have to pay big interest payments on it, well, then the government taxes the taxpayers. And let's say, you know, the interest payment is $10 trillion. And then they hand that $10 trillion over to somebody else who's alive in 2011. So, you know, Dean Baker and Paul Krugman and Warren Mosler are trying to say, look at you guys, that, you know, for us to pass along a big government debt, all that means is money's going to be getting moved around among our grandchildren, but we're not going to collectively make all of our grandchildren poorer because we ran deficits today. It's just, you know, it might change the distribution of wealth at that future time, but it's not going to change the aggregate amount of wealth. Okay, so that's what they mean, and it's actually compelling, and I used to believe that too, that, you know, insofar as that argument went, I used to think, okay, yeah, that's true, you know, we can't literally take food away from the year 2100. But the problem with that, and this is something that Nobel laureate James Buchanan pointed out, and then the way I became aware of it was Don Boudreau, the current economics chair of George Mason University, and then, like you said, Andy, this economist Nick Rowe, this monetary theorist out of Canada, were going nuts when Krugman and Baker were making this mistake and pointing out the problem. So the reason it's wrong is that what can happen is you can have a situation where the government runs big deficits today, and so that, like, you know, they give $100 billion of more drug coverage to seniors, let's say, and they pay for it by borrowing the money. So maybe there are working class people, you know, people who are working, you know, 30s, 40-year-olds, they lend money to the government today, so they reduce their consumption and they buy government bonds, and that's how the government pays for the $100 billion payment today. Then when those people get to be 60 years old, 20 years from now, they don't just hand the bonds over to their kids who are now the, you know, who would be the grandkids of the, from today's perspective. They sell them, right? So that's what I mean. When you're thinking, if you're retired, if you have a bunch of savings in a mutual fund or whatever in the form of treasuries, government bonds, the way you start enjoying your retirement is you start selling those into the market. And people who are now working when you're retiring, out of their paycheck, take some of the money and give it to you. And that's how you go on vacations and how you send, you know, birthday presents to your own grandchildren and so forth when you're retired. So the point is the what ends up happening, yeah, the people in the year 2100, it's true, the government is taxing some of them for interest payments on the bonds and handing it over to other people who are alive in 2100, but that's not a wash. It's not just saying, oh, you took $10 trillion from some Americans and gave it over to some other ones. What that misses is that the reason the people getting the interest payments in the year 2100, the reason they have those bonds is because earlier in their career, they had to reduce their own consumption in order to get the bonds from the people who were holding them. And so it's this weird, like, piggyback thing where the debt keeps getting shifted to the next generation in exchange for people paying whatever the market price is of those bonds at that time. And so it's not just a wash that it's the people who are alive in 2100, a bunch of them had to live very parsimoniously when they were younger in order to be in the position to receive those interest payments. So it's not a zero-sum game. The people in 2100 who are getting taxed heavily to pay the interest on the government debt are clearly down because they're getting taxed. And then the people who are getting that payment are just being compensated for them having to reduce their consumption earlier on in their life. And so on net, everybody in the year 2100 is poorer in terms of their lifetime because of this huge debt that we passed down.
Okay.
All right. So that's, and it's a subtle thing, but that is what's wrong with what Mosler's doing here. And he just, the way he's modeling it, he doesn't take that possibility into account. He just assumes the people in 2100 inherit all the debt first from scratch and then start from go in the year 2100. And that's not how it happens.
Sure. Well, and this doesn't really, I mean, I'm sure that what happened to all of the debt that was owed in Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe, like Argentina, I mean, obviously lots of, when it came to a point where though the debt burden could not be serviced, obviously there was a collapse in the currency, and that, so, but I'm sure this you're not even discussing that angle. You're discussing just rolling over the debt and passing it along. You're still going to be poor net on net. Is that a fair statement?
Right. I mean, because the thing is, I mean, what you're saying is true, right? So, but there, the way somebody like Mosler would handle that is he'd say, whoa, I didn't, I never said that the government could just spend whatever it wanted. I was just being crystal clear that they, in that kind of scenario, what's hurting those people is the inflation. You know, it's not the debt burden per se. I mean, they could just, they could print it up and pay people. So it's not that the deficit per se or the debt per se impoverished anybody. It was just that the inflation, the money printing did.
Okay.
And so you're right. I mean, you could say, but yeah, but the whole reason they had to print so much money was because of this huge debt and that, they owed all of this dollar denominated, outflow to people. So I'm not saying what you said was wrong, but I'm just saying, again, Mosler could play this cute game where, you just ruined the whole country, but let's put the right label on the cause of the ruin.
Okay.
But I'm saying even on his own terms, even in terms of his accounting and stuff, he is just flat out wrong on this particular one because he's not seeing this subtle possibility of intergenerational passing down of the debt and how it's not just – because what Mosler is thinking implicitly is that every generation just literally bequeaths the bonds to their heirs without – expecting anything in return, but in reality, to the extent that the way the bonds end up in the hands of younger people every 20 years is that the younger people, at least some of them, have to pay for them, well, then that shows the problem, again, even on his own mathematical terms of what Mosler's talking about here.
Okay. Well, and I would invite, you have a pretty, you have a good couple of threads on this on your blog where you make some good thought experiments where you're showing scenarios of how this would work, and it plays better for people to go and see that on your blog, and we'll link to that as well for this section. So we'll take a quick break here. We're discussing modern monetary theory with Dr. Robert T. Murphy. Please stay with us. All right, thank you for staying with us. We are discussing modern monetary theory with Dr. Robert P. Murphy, and discussing specifically Warren Mosler's book, Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds of Economic Policy. It's always a mouthful to remember that. So right now we're going to look at his third fraud, which is, quote, government budget deficits take away savings. So that's a fraud, and according to Mosler. And Mosler's response is essentially, federal government budget deficits add to savings. So this is kind of this is definitely one that needs to be addressed, because you wrote a great article called The Upside Down World of Modern Monetary Theory, or MMT, addressing this specific fraud. So why don't you take a stab at that?
Sure. So here, and the way for your listeners, if they argue with these types of guys on the internet, a lot of times the way this manifests itself, this particular issue, is people will say stuff like, a federal government deficit adds to the net assets of the economy, whereas if the government runs a surplus, that reduces net private assets. All right. And so what they're doing there is they're drawing a line down in terms of the accounting, and they're putting the private sector to one side and then the government sector on the other side. And so they're saying, look, just in terms of the raw accounting, if the government runs a deficit, that means it owes more to the bondholders, right? And the bondholders, by definition, are the people in the private sector, if we're talking about, you know, governments, the government's net outstanding debt held by the public. And so they're saying, you know, the public, you know, in other words, like an individual household, if I save a bunch of money and I lend $1,000 to Uncle Sam so he can go spend it, and I'm holding a treasury bond that has a current market value of $1,000, is that part of my assets? And I'd say, yeah, of course it is. That's why I saved it. That's why I did it. You know, it's a lot of people would say it's a very safe asset, the safest thing you can have. And so they're just aggregating that over the whole private sector and saying that's true. You know, it doesn't net to zero if you're doing the whole private sector, because the person who owes all that, or the entity that owes all that, is the government. And so that's what they're saying. In that sense, when the government runs a deficit, it increases the net assets of the private sector. Okay, so my simple observation there is that, you know, let's do the raw accounting first. That's a very odd way of looking at it, that that's technically true insofar as it goes, but how is the government going to pay you back? It's by taxing people in the next period. Right, or in the future at some point. Yep. And so, you know, it would be like if I went up to you and said, hey, you know, here's a piece of paper that says I, you know, Bob Murphy, owe you $1,000 next Friday. And then next Friday comes along and you say, okay, give me my $1,000, and I stick a gun in your belly and I say, okay, here, take $1,000 out of your wallet, give it to me, and then, you know, you do. And then I give you the $1,000 right back and say, there you go, I paid you off, let me rip up that piece of paper. And that's the sense in which the federal government, you know, can enrich us and give us net private assets by running deficits. Because yes, that's true. Everybody who holds one of those government bonds is going to get some money next period. And how is the government going to get that? Well, and again, here, it's going to tax it, or they're going to run the printing press, so they could say, you know, oh no, we're not taxed. But again, this goes back to that first myth that we talked about, or fraud, whatever he's calling it, where he's trying to say it's not impoverishing everybody if the government just runs the printing press, but it does, you know, whether they take the money directly out of, you know, in terms of taxes and literally take money out of your hands, or whether they print up more $100 bills and dilute the purchasing power of your money. Either way, when the government is spending and having control over resources, that is redistributing purchasing power from everybody else, whether they just keep the money supply constant and take it from you directly, or whether they dilute your particular holdings of cash by printing up more cash. So once you get that little aspect of it, I mean, technically, yeah, there's a sense in which it's true that a government deficit adds to savings, but it's weird when the savings are coming out of, you know, them taking wealth away from everybody else again.
And talk about, in your article, you talk about what do modern monetary theorists or MMTers, how do they consider net savings? Is that really, you wrote in your article, they have a different idea of what we mean by net savings than we think. We think savings, we think we're working, we're prolonging consumption, and we have savings. But I feel like they have something different in mind.
Yeah, well, I think, there's like this, when people say, in terms of someone who might utter this so-called innocent fraud, saying that, oh, a government budget doesn't takes away from savings, they have this idea that the private sector has a certain amount of production, and then, and that's collectively everybody's income, and then out of that, you decide how much do I want to consume and how much do I want to save, and then if the government comes along and runs a budget deficit, then it has to siphon away some of those savings. So that's the conventional economic sense in which, somebody might say that the thing that Moser's calling a fraud here. And so the other things equal, if the government's running a bigger deficit, that's leaving less savings available for private sector investment. And the way that a lot of these MMT guys define terms, the private sector can't save on net because for every thing that's an asset, that's just a claim on some other entity, right? So like if I lend money to a corporation by buying its bonds, then there's not net saving there that I've saved, but the corporation has dissaved because now it's deeper into debt. You see what I'm saying? So in their mind, there's no way the private sector as a whole within itself can save on net in a certain definition of the term saving, unless they lend to the government, because then that's an entity that's outside of the private sector. And so there's no corresponding debt increase among a private sector entity if somebody there saves by lending to the government. And that's the sense in which if the government goes deeper into debt, the private sector goes deeper into surplus.
Okay.
But again, I'm just saying that's, and I think one thing I did too in the article was to say, I mean, if I wanted to, I could just draw a line around Google. And say when
Yes.
Google, if Google borrows money, then planet Earth minus Google gains a net asset. And we could just do the accounting like that and then make it look like, oh my gosh, if Google has a good quarter and saves a bunch of money, then it's making the rest of planet Earth poorer. When that would technically be true the way that the MMT guys do the accounting. But that would be crazy, to think like that. And so I'm saying it's similar with the government, except it's even worse because the way the government pays you back is by taking money from you or by just printing up more money rather than, engaging in productive services and generating future income that way, out of which they can then repay the money they owe you.
Sure. And I think it's just looking at this, it seems like they're missing the whole idea of capital formation and how the capital structure works, and treating the whole economy as a zero-sum game instead of a something that can grow. Is that a fair statement, or is that just since it's not in accounting, you can't represent that in an accounting model, they don't really address that.
Yeah, it's a fair statement. So there, what's happening here, and again, this is like a good example of the whole enterprise and what I think is fundamentally wrong with the way these guys approach things. In terms of accounting, or sorry, in terms of economics, yeah, I mean, we have the standard fables of Robinson Crusoe on the island, and he's got labor and so forth and natural resources, and he can just, pick 10 coconuts per day, and he can just keep eating them, and then he's not going to get anywhere. Or he can only eat 8 coconuts a day and start saving, and he starts accumulating a big stockpile of coconuts. And then once he gets a big stockpile, then he spends his labor building a fishing net. And then while he eats the coconuts and draws down his savings, and he does, makes a long stick or something, takes vines and makes the stick real long. So now he's got tools, and he goes around and can hit the coconuts with the long stick, or he can go fishing with the fishing net and blah, blah, blah. And his standard of living rises over time because he saved and invested. But the way the MMT guys would look at that, they would have to say, well, there's no government, and so clearly there's no net financial assets being accumulated in this world. And so the way they define their term, they're not wrong. You say, yeah, that's true. That, Crusoe doesn't, nobody owes him money. There is no money in the, but there's a definite economic sense in which you can distinguish between saving and consumption, and what an investment versus consumption and so forth. And clearly your standard of living goes up if you engage in saving and investment in that sense of the terms. And the MMT guys are using them in slightly different terms in order to get their truisms to work.
Sure. Very good. Okay, let's go on to the next one is number four. Social Security is broken. And Mosler's response is, government can cover any shortfall with its, you know, with its scorekeeper or its reserve accounting fiat money machine. So, what I think this is a fairly easy one for somebody that knows basic economics to see the fallacy here.
Right. I mean, and this is just an outgrowth of his first alleged innocent fraud. You know, that he's basically just saying that there's never a point at which the government, in terms of accounting, would be unable to pay a bill. And so he's saying it doesn't matter if the amount of money coming in through Social Security contribute, you know, what they call contributions euphemistically, you know, from worker payrolls, taxes, and so on. It doesn't matter whether there's a point at which all that's insufficient to cover the outgoing payments, and then they've even whittled down the so-called trust fund to zero. So what? The government can just run the printing press, metaphorically. I mean, like I said, Mosler gets into the mechanics of electronic debits and credits and how they would actually do that. But again, just it's no different economically than if they just ran a printing press and paid Social Security beneficiaries that way with newly printed $100 bills.
Sure.
And so, yeah, again, I mean, this is sort of, yeah, he's technically correct. Nothing is broken in that sense, but in actuarial GAAP accounting terms, Social Security is insolvent, that the present value of its liabilities is higher than the present value of its assets, including all projected incoming payroll taxes and, you know, and from employer and employee side. So, I mean, so this is kind of funny that even under standard rules of accounting, Social Security is insolvent. And so what would it mean to say it's broken? Well, I think that if it's insolvent, that's what it would mean. And he's basically just getting around that by saying, no, the government can just print whatever money it needs to. And then again, he would come back and say, oh, I grant you, if they print too much, then that's going to cause unacceptably high price inflation and people be poor because of the inflation. And so, this is the kind of thing I mean, where he's trying to sort of make people think that Social Security is in serious trouble when all he's really doing is saying, oh, the issue wouldn't be the liabilities of Social Security per se or the actuarial tables. It would just be the fact that the government has to print so much money that now eggs cost $20 a piece and gasoline's $100 a gallon. So,
sure.
You know, and so it's kind of like, oh, well, thanks, Mr. Mosler, that's, you're just clarifying the way in which these Social Security entitlements are going to make us all be incredibly poor.
Sure. And I think, I've read a couple of sources, maybe it was Gary North, about the insolvency, or let me say this, let me retract that. The alleged insolvency of Social Security was, like the deficit was a present value of, $222 trillion. Of what was needed right now to invest in Social Security or basically put it in its Al Gore lockbox to make it solvent going forward. Have you seen that statistic as well?
I have, the thing with that is just the numbers bounce all over the place. Like if you go to the actual trustees report, so the government's own figures and so on, and go and look at the one that came out, I think it was in June or something like that. And there, I want to say the number was something like, oh, what was it? If you're including Medicare, it was, I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, it was between 60 and 80 trillion. It was the unfunded liability. And so you say, well, how can the numbers be so different? I think part of it is the smaller number uses a shorter time horizon. So like they only go out 75 years and then stop.
Sure.
So, because the reason this is all screwy, of course, is that the changing demographics, that as the population ages, then the amount of workers who are supporting a given retiree shifts. And since Social Security is a pay-as-you-go system, when those demographics change, that makes the thing not work. And so the further out in time you project, the worse it gets. And so the bigger the time horizon, the worse from a present value accounting perspective is this gap. So yeah, you're right that I've seen figures as high as $222 trillion, and you're right. What that means, people say, what the heck does that even mean to say right now you know, these entitlements are underfunded by that amount of money, like you say, it means in order to keep the thing perpetually running, you would need to right now have $222 trillion in hand to invest in the market at a safe conservative rate, such that over time, when there was a shortfall between how much they owed beneficiaries versus what they were taking in new revenues from existing workers, to fund that gap, you would draw down on this humongous thing that was started at $222 trillion today and started rolling over exponentially. And that's how much you would need to never go broke. And so that just gives people an idea of how incredibly off the system is and why we're so confident in saying it is unsustainable. They're going to have to cut Social Security benefits. They're going to have to make workers work longer. They're going to have to raise the taxes to fund Social Security and so on, and Medicare and so on. There's just no way this is going to work.
But according to Warren Mosler, we can, no problem. We have a fiat money machine, so no worries there. So the number five, fraud number five, the trade deficit is an unsustainable imbalance that takes away jobs and output. And Mosler's response to this fraud is, imports are real benefits and exports are real costs. Trade deficits directly improve our standard of living. Jobs are lost because taxes are too high for a given level of government spending, not because of imports. So let's reflect on this, because I think there's probably some agreement on this one.
Yeah, this is, and so just to show that we're not beating up on the guy because we don't like him, this particular one, not only do I agree with him on the narrow legalese reading of it, I actually think that the economics of what he's saying is correct also, that yes, when it comes to international trade, the conventional man on the street fear is that a trade deficit is a bad thing, and they would think that, oh no, we want to be sending more of our stuff abroad and you know, making them buy our product rather than us buying their stuff. And as Mosler is pointing out, that well no, I mean, just think about it. Isn't it good when other people around the world are working and sending us cars and TVs and stuff like that? Like, isn't it better when people are sending you goods rather than you having to send them stuff? And so he's right. Now, it's true that depending on how sophisticated you make it, what assumptions you make, a trade deficit could be unsustainable under various assumptions, that why would the rest of the world continue to keep sending us cars and food and so forth and sweaters and whatever year after year, you know, sending us more stuff than we're sending to them. Why would they keep doing that? And so on any given year, they do it because they start accumulating financial assets, claims on our future output. And so there's no reason that you couldn't do that for a while, but you might think after a long time, eventually things would go the other way. So I mean, it's not like it's a free lunch, but I think he is correct in saying that this is an area where I think the conventional wisdom is wrong. And also because, I mean, here, part of the backdrop is the framework is these are all voluntary transactions. And so just like, you know, it would be silly for me, like I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and so I have a huge trade surplus with the state of Tennessee, that I sell way more goods and services to people in the state of Tennessee than vice versa. And I have a big trade deficit if I go to Florida on vacation, because I don't have any clients that live in Florida, so I don't earn any income from people within the state of Florida, but if I go on there on vacation, I spend a lot. And it'd be weird for me to worry about my unsustainable trade deficit with the state of Florida. So, I mean, it's a similar kind of thing. If what works for a household, when you do it at the country level, you're just aggregating it. So if the United States happens to have a trade deficit with the rest of the world, that really doesn't mean anything.
Sure. Well, and I guess some nuances for the trade deficit kind of go into these floating exchange rates of currencies, and obviously that you have countries that are trying to devalue theirs or trying to peg their currency to another's, like China to the United States when they used to do that. And I think on net he's correct in the sense that imports are benefits. Like, my ideal would be to retire and not work and basically live off of my savings in the sense that everything is going to be kind of an import in the sense that I'm living off of my savings or I'm living off of, you know, Mai Tais on, in some tropical island. So, whereas exports, if we work and work and work and we give all of our the fruits of our labor away and maybe get to keep a tenth of that, that's a cost and not necessarily a benefit. So,
right, and of course,
do you agree with that?
Yeah, and the two go hand in hand too. That if you look at the average person over his life cycle, in a sense, he would be running trade surpluses with the rest of planet Earth during his working years as he's building up his savings. And then you're right, once he retires and he's not earning an income but he's still consuming a lot, from that point forward he'd be running massive trade deficits.
Yep.
But that's fine because over the whole life cycle, you know, and so it's and then you could say, oh, but with a country, you know, so but you're still admitting it's unsustainable. Well, not necessarily, because you could flip it and say, well, what if I'm talking about, oh, there's somebody in his 20s and he's running massive trade deficits. And you say, oh, no, he's going to have to really reduce his consumption in the future because of that, right? And then I tell you, no, because what he's doing is he's going to medical school to become a brain surgeon. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's not earning an income right now while he's getting trained, but he's, you know, in New York City or wherever, and he has a high expense, you know, he has a high consumption rate. But then later down on the road, because of the investments he's making in his education, he's going to have a really high income, and his standard of living is going to keep rising. So it's the trade deficits would eventually go away, but it wouldn't lead to calamity.
Sure.
So you could have analogous situations on a macro level with a country like the United States, for example, in the 19th century, for certain periods was running massive trade deficits with the rest of the world because they were investing in the U.S., like building up railroads and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's one way of seeing it, that a trade deficit is a capital account surplus. So if the rest of the world wants to invest more in U.S. assets than vice versa, then necessarily the United States has to run a trade deficit with the rest of the world. So that's maybe one way of putting it, where a trade deficit seems bad. Where we're like, oh, no, Americans are consuming too much, when it could be the other way around. I say, what if American institutions and legal structures are so great that investors around the world just want to put their wealth into the U.S., well, for them to be able to do that, then there needs to be a trade deficit. And it kind of makes sense that people around the world are like trying to send steel and other resources into the U.S. to invest in our productive capacity. On the books, that shows up as more goods flowing into the U.S. than flowing out.
Sure.
So.
Yes, excellent. So let's go on to the next one, number six. This is another fraud. The fraud is, we need savings to provide the funds for investment. And Mosler's response is, investment adds to savings. Now this is very confusing for me, because I've read this part a couple of times. I really don't understand what he's trying to get at. Is he kind of presenting a paradox of thrift argument? I'm not sure here.
Well, at the very least, where he's coming from is based on the same sort of thought process that leads to the so-called paradox of thrift. So, yeah, he's saying that, look, what he's leapfrogging from is the fact that he's saying income is not a fixed thing. So what he's claiming here is that there's a fallacy of composition going on, meaning that what's true at the individual micro household level, you can't then extrapolate it to the whole economy. So from an individual household point of view, you think that your income is fixed, right? That I have a certain salary for my job. I have investments in the, you know, mutual fund or whatever. I have maybe money on deposit with the bank and they're paying me interest. So I have a certain amount of income this year, and that's a fixed number. And then I can decide, do I want to consume all of it by going out to dinner and buying clothes and so forth, going on vacations, or do I want to save and invest a lot of it? And the assumption is that your actions are not going to change what your income was. But he's saying you can't assume that at the national macroeconomic level, because what happens is if I invest, then I am generating income for somebody else. And so then that in turn, because now other people have a higher income, that allows them to save more. And so it's sort of like, you know, it's like a bootstrapping thing where, you know, if everybody collectively decides to invest more, that's more spending. And so that's, you know, if I invest $1,000, that's going to turn into income to somebody else. And so that gives them the wherewithal to then save more. And so that's the sense in which, in terms of the accounting and the bookkeeping, he's saying, oh, look at the bigger investment is, the bigger savings can be, because it makes income go up.
Okay, so this is more right off of his, is more of his accounting equation logic. And
yeah, I think there's a sense in which if you do the accounting a certain way, what he's saying is technically right. Although even there, I mean, we don't want to get by, it would be kind of hard for me to do it verbally, but even there, I think there's, I mean,
this goes back to your, you know, the G minus T equals, S minus I. Is that right?
Yeah, right.
The, G is government, spending minus taxes on the one side that you have, and then on the right side, it's, savings minus investment.
Yeah, so it's rather, what we could do is just point the read, you know, the technical readers, we can point them to that and they can see me try to deal with it in terms of the actual accounting and show why I think even on its own terms it's a bit misleading. But stepping back from it again, just think back to that Robinson Crusoe analogy. You know, clearly there is a genuine economic sense in which Robinson Crusoe cannot, you know, if he wants to save, he has to first have an income. He has to have production. Right? And then, so he has to go pick a bunch of, he can't save three coconuts unless he's first produced the three coconuts. And I mean, you know, he climbed the trees and grabbed them with his bare hands, let's say. And then if he wants to save, that means he has to abstain from consuming that which he could consume, which he has the ability to. That's what savings is. And then to invest means now he's gonna devote his time and other labor resources to, producing capital goods. Alright? So it wouldn't work for the, in an economic physical sense to say of to Crusoe that, oh no, you can go ahead and invest without cutting back on current consumption, which is saving. Then why don't you just go ahead and invest, and then out of the bounty that your investment yields you, then you'll get the savings that will, you know, account for the investment and make it possible. And you'd say, well no, you just gotten cause and effect backwards. I don't have a time machine. I have to first save in order to then have resources that I can choose to invest.
Sure.
You can't invest first, and that somehow, because of accounting, gives me the resources. So, you know, the point is, yeah, things get a little bit trickier when you look at a whole economy with millions of people, but the same logic of the just sheer physics of it, the time flows a certain direction, and you have to have resources that you're devoting to investment before you're building capital equipment and so on, before the output flows from those new investments, there is a time lag. And Mosler is just like sort of making the period of accounting encompass the beginning and the end, and then saying, oh no, well in terms of these variables in my accounting, if investment goes up, the only way to keep the equation in balance is for savings to go up. But in actual terms of physics, no, there, you have to have savings first in order to then have investment.
Gotcha. Well, and when they say invest, and he says investment, he's thinking more government. This kind of goes back to his government spending or deficit spending, is as he would equate that to being investment. Am I wrong there, or is he really meaning investment comes before savings, or is adds to the pool of savings?
I'm not as confident with this as some of the other stuff we've been talking about, but I believe he's saying, even if we just look at the private sector.
Okay.
In other words, I think, so I mean, you're right. He would think if the government runs a deficit, that's going to give us more income and so forth, which that might fuel some higher investment spending. But I think he would say, even if we just look at the private sector and there were no government, that, if people invested more, that would then allow for them to save more.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, well, we're going to take a quick little break and be right back. We're talking with Robert P. Murphy about modern monetary theory. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you for staying with us. We're talking with Robert P. Murphy about modern monetary theory, and specifically Warren Mosler's book, Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds of Economic Policy. And we are just about to wrap this up, and we're going to tackle the last fraud here. Number seven, and it says, it's a bad thing that higher deficits today mean higher taxes tomorrow. And Mosler's response is, I agree, the innocent fraud is that it's a bad thing, when in fact it's a good thing. So he's saying, I guess that's worded a little tricky there. He's saying that if we do have taxes, higher taxes in the future, that is a bad thing because MMTers are not big on taxes because they think that we can borrow as much or print as much as we'd like. So, do you have some comments on that?
Sure. Let me clarify. You're right. He's saying I agree, but the statement with which he's agreeing has it's a bad thing in it, and then he's saying I'm just disagreeing that it's a bad thing. So you're right. Strictly speaking, this is a horrible grammar. Here's what he's saying. He's saying the innocent fraud that this, you know, the myth that he wants to dispute is this. It's a bad thing that higher deficits today mean higher taxes tomorrow. So now when Mosler comes along, he says, oh, I agree. What he's agreeing with is to say higher deficits today mean higher taxes tomorrow. But where he disagrees is he wants to say that's actually a good thing. And, if you read his commentary on this part, where he's coming from is he's saying, look, if we're, let's say today we're in a recession, and so we want to, generate more purchasing power for the private sector. We want to be able to boost income. We want to make people in the private sector richer. How do we do that? Oh, the government can run a big deficit, and that will increase net private financial assets, that will raise income, the government spending money, that will raise incomes on the recipients of that spending and so forth, and that will start pushing down unemployment. And then especially if the deficit, because what does that mean? The government is spending more than it takes in. So that's the very crude, naive sense in which a government budget deficit in and of itself, Mosler's arguing, is sort of enriching the private sector because the government's pumping more money in than it's taking out. And so then he's saying, oh, but wait a minute, down the road, because now they have a higher government debt and they have to service it by making interest payments, won't that other things equal mean that they probably have to have higher taxes to service the debt? And he's saying, yeah, but remember, it's never an issue of they have to raise taxes down the road to service the debt, because they could always just tax zero and just always print money. And the constraint is the reason in Mosler's system, he says the reason the government taxes is not because the government needs to do that in order to be able to spend money. They can just run the printing press. The reason you would tax is when price inflation is getting out of hand and you want to sop up some of that purchasing power to keep price hikes more stable. And so his point is, if it makes sense to run a deficit today in order to fix the unemployment problem, then down the road, if we're worried because price inflation is too high and we need to raise taxes for that reason, well, that's fine, because by definition, then that means down the road we're in a booming economy with rising prices, and so it's fine if the government comes along and taxes to try to keep things from overheating, that's what you'd want the government to do. So he's saying, yeah, There is this general pattern where when you're in a recession, the government runs deficits, and then later on during a boom, they have higher taxes to service the debt. But he's saying that's exactly how you would want it.
So this is more of a Keynesian. This sounds very, very much like a Keynesian argument that the main point of taxes is to regulate aggregate demand, or to, if there's too much inflation, to kind of like sop up with like a sponge all of this excess cash that's floating around. Would that be a fair statement?
It's similar to stuff that you probably heard in terms of counter-cyclical policy from a standard Keynesian perspective. In fact, a lot of and here's where I said we're brushing up against areas where I'm not exactly sure the different divisions and schools of thought, but I think a lot of the people who call themselves post-Keynesians endorse a lot of this stuff. There is a lot of overlap there. I think that, but I do know, for example, that Paul Krugman has sort of taken issue with this, and he has said that I agree with these guys that, you know, like with James Galbraith and people like that. I agree that right now during our liquidity crunch or liquidity trap and so forth with the up against the zero lower bound with interest rates, I agree that deficits, government budget deficits aren't a problem. But I can't go so far as some of these guys, you know, as MMT people and so forth, and say that budget constraints are never an issue for government. And so, I mean, the standard Keynesian might end up with the same policy proposals, but the way they talk about them would be different. Because whereas, remember, for Mosler, he's saying, no, under no circumstances is the government ever unable to pay its bills. It's never insolvent because they can just print more money. You know, they have an infinite present value of their assets in terms of the denomination of the currency. So, and Krugman in that post, I remember, was making the same basic points that we were here, saying, come on, I mean, at some point if they're printing money, there's going to be unacceptably high price inflation, eventually the currency would collapse. And so we should probably say that too. This is a general summing up of this. Their fundamental assumption at step one actually is very vulnerable. And is the quicksand upon which they build their whole framework, is to say, assume you have a country that has its own fiat currency, that it can then, you know, have assets denominated in that, and that can break down. If they print too much money, the currency can literally collapse, and nobody uses it anymore, and then it's no longer true that the people living in that jurisdiction have their own currency. You know, they have to use gold or they have to use the dollar or something. You know, if it's some other country and their currency collapses because of hyperinflation, then they use some other currency. So even on its own terms, there is a constraint. And if they do too much, it's not merely the case that, oh, well, then prices would rise higher than the public might want. It's that, no, if they do it too much and they foolishly think that, hey, Social Security is not an issue and the government, you know, never can spend as much as it wants, and the only issue is price inflation. No. If people around the world stop accepting it and the currency collapses and the people domestically switch to another currency, then their fundamental assumption at step one, that let's assume we're dealing with a system where they issue their own fiat currency, that falls away.
Sure. Well, and I think he has this premise that underlies it, that the dollar will remain the reserve currency for infinity. Maybe I'm wrong on that assumption, but it sounds like, you know, if you issue debt in your own currency, you can pretty much cover any debt you need to. And he actually does discuss in the later parts of the book that are not on the fraud section, or his seven frauds, but he talks about going to another country's finance minister and talking about, oh, yeah, you can just print money here. And the guy's like, oh yeah, you're right, great. so this is, I don't know, this is, I feel,
well,
like,
well, yeah, just to comment on that, so you're right, and that's, he would say it's stronger, so it, I don't know whether he thinks the dollar will be the world reserve currency or not indefinitely, but Mosler would say the case he's making in this book at least doesn't depend on that, and just for the anecdote you brought up, that I think it was the one I have in mind, is Australia, and that they were trying to tell him, okay, yeah, Warren, the stuff you're saying is kind of true for the U.S. because you got the whole world accepting the dollar, but for us, you know, a small open economy, then your stuff doesn't work. And he went through that logic with their own former finance minister, or whoever the guy was.
Right.
Right. And got them to see that, no, because you guys have your own fiat currency, I don't care how big or small you are, the logic of what I'm saying is the same, and you guys can pay your bills denominated in that currency, can't you? And they say, oh, yeah, you're right. So he would say that it doesn't depend on the dollar being a reserve currency, but the point is still, it depends on people still accepting the dollar.
Right.
That if everyone just stops using the dollar because it's lost so much of its purchasing power and it's so volatile, and there's only four people on planet Earth who accept Federal Reserve notes anymore, then all of Mosler's stuff kind of becomes completely irrelevant.
Sure. Well, we've made it through all seven deadly innocent frauds. I was going to say seven deadly sins, but The Seven Deadly Instant Frauds by Warren Mosler. I encourage people to read it, but also to use our podcast, hopefully, as a primer to it, if they want to dig into the arguments that the book presents. But I just to wrap up, I'd like to thank Dr. Robert Murphy for walking us through this. For all people interested in Dr. Murphy's work, I would encourage people to go to KrugmanDebate.com, as well as academy.mises, that's MISES.org, as well as his website, his blog called Free Advice at consultingbyrpm.com/blog. Those are all great sites you need to visit, and especially for the KrugmanDebate.com. Could you walk us through a little bit of what that's all about?
Sure. So Paul Krugman, of course, is the Nobel laureate, who's famous for being a staunch proponent of Keynesian policy solutions for the crisis. And I challenged him to a debate, so I was going to defend Austrian business cycle theory, and Krugman, of course, would be taking the Keynesian position. And to make it interesting and to sort of give him an incentive to do it, I have a fundraiser where people can pledge. So your credit card doesn't actually get billed unless Krugman actually debates me. So you're just making a conditional pledge. It's not actually a donation. And you're just, you know, you're signing in and saying how much you would put up. And then the way this thing works is if Krugman debates me, then everyone's credit card gets charged and then the money goes to a food bank in New York City. And so as of right now, there's over $80,000 that people have pledged who want to see Krugman debate me. And so as that number ticks up, it just puts more pressure on Krugman to go ahead and debate me and then have that money go to the food bank in New York City. So all that stuff, plus I made some funny videos, and there was one time when Krugman on his blog actually did critique an article I wrote on Austrian business cycle theory. So that's all linked there. So that's the website for all that stuff is KrugmanDebate.com.
Great. And it's quite a brilliant ploy. It's more of a kind of a Groupon type of a model. Is that a fair statement to this?
Yeah.
You know, everybody doesn't have to pay unless he agrees to debate. So that balance on that register is just going to keep going up and up and up.
Right. Yeah, it's exactly right. So people are familiar with Groupon. Actually, the particular website that's handling the mechanics of this, because I'm not doing it. You know, it's not like you're giving money to me. It's a third party system, and it's called The Point, and they are the predecessors of Groupon. That Groupon was once they set up this generic thing, The Point, and then they realized the real market for this is with discounts for shopping, and that's how Groupon was born, out of this predecessor site that KrugmanDebate.com will link you to if you're interested in making a pledge.
Awesome. Well, we invite all of our listeners to visit that and pledge some money, any money that they can. So again, we thank you, Dr. Murphy, for being with us, and hope to have you back for maybe another topic that's maybe a little bit more understandable than MMT.
Well, thanks for having me, Andy.
Okay. This has been Liberty for Laban podcast. Thank you for listening.